They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We learned a little something about the economy this morning. Gross domestic product last quarter was even worse than we thought, not even growing a full percent a year. Some blame the housing market, some blame businesses. One sector you can't blame, though, banking. There was yet another financial buyout today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, also sponsoring PBS's CEO Exchange, shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. So glad to have you with us on this Thursday. Today is the last day of May, which means you ought to be getting your bank statements in the mail any day now. Provided, of course, you haven't gone paperless in your personal financial life. If you have, then you're probably a banking minimalist anyway. No full service for you. You'll just do it all yourself. Savings and checking accounts, mutual fund investing, stock trading, the whole deal. You're also part of the reason why Wachovia decided today to part with more than $6.5 billion. The nation's fourth largest bank will be buying A.G. Edwards to become one of the biggest retail brokerages, too. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
When Wachovia's retail brokerage division finishes absorbing A.G. Edwards, it'll hold more than $1 trillion in client assets. That'll make it the third biggest retail brokerage in the country after Merrill Lynch and Citigroup. Punk's Eagle analyst Richard Beauvais says Wachovia clients will have access to a full menu of brokerage and banking services.
The acquisition is to get hold of customers and to then use those distribution points, i.e. the salespeople, to sell a wide variety of products that go well beyond anything that A.G. Edwards was selling before.
Beauvais says full-service brokerages have lost business to do-it-yourselfers. Companies like E-Trade and Charles Schwab let clients buy stocks and mutual funds directly. They've made trading securities very cheap. But Gerard Cassidy of RBC Capital Markets says there's a high cost to those cheap trades.
The financial advice that you get from an E-Trade or Charles Schwab is very, very limited. A full-service broker-dealer, however, can give you much more in-depth financial planning advice, which many of the baby boomers will need.
He says Wachovia is guessing that by offering investment guidance, it can bring boomer clients back into the full-service fold. As more companies switch to the 401k model of pension plans, people have more choice and need more help managing their money. Wachovia Securities will move its headquarters from Richmond to St. Louis, hometown to A.G. Edwards. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The sneaker company turned full-service athletic apparel maker Nike released its latest report on corporate responsibility today. It's its third since 2001. The first two broke new ground in the movement to make companies more accountable for how they get their goods to consumers. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details on report number three.
Corporate responsibility at Nike means more than crisis management. Nike's Hannah Jones says corporate good citizenship is now incorporated into the business model.
We're not going to be taking just an approach of creating one green line or one ethical trade line. Our approach is to try and take a $15 billion company and build environmental and labor conditions into that model.
Jones says a new approach to product design will reduce waste and help transition to a climate neutral company.
All footwear by financial year 2011 will meet our baseline environmental standards, which focuses on reducing waste, reducing toxic chemicals, and looking at how we can innovate and create product that can be recycled or reused.
Nike also plans to eliminate excess overtime at its factories and plans to train workers and management about the freedom of association, including the right to organize. This could be an important step. Bama Athreya is executive director of the International Labor Rights Fund.
It still is a major labor rights issue in most of the production facilities that there are not independent unions to give workers the opportunity to voice their concerns and express their concerns and bargain for better working conditions.
Athreya says Nike and other apparel companies put too much pressure on factories to keep prices flat. That makes it hard, she argues, for factories to provide fair wages and decent working conditions. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Wall Street didn't break much new ground today. That GDP report cooled things a bit, and investors weren't swayed by the Wachovia deal either. Still, though, another new record for the S&P 500 by just a hair. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Bush made a counteroffer of sorts today on the topic of global warming. The United States has largely been on the defensive about climate change, especially as it's been heating up as a political issue. With the G8 summit next week sure to bring more pressure, the president's proposing a new round of negotiations on cutting greenhouse gases. Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. The president's last-minute change of heart is getting a few cheers, a couple of boos, but mostly surprise.
President Bush has resisted calls to join a climate change agreement for years. Today, he startled many of his own critics by unveiling his own plan to fight global warming.
By the end of next year, America and other nations will set a long-term global goal for reducing greenhouse gases. To help develop this goal, the United States would convene a series of meetings of nations that produced most greenhouse gas emissions, including nations with rapidly growing economies like India and China.
David Hayes, former Deputy Secretary of the Interior under President Clinton, says Bush is under enormous pressure to change his global warming stance, but his announcement today left it unclear whether he's ready to regulate greenhouse gases.
What everyone's going to be looking for is, does this president agree that we have to have a cap as a constraint, or is he basically proposing aspirational goals? And if that is the case, I think there'll be a big yawn in the international community and certainly by U.S. businesses on this.
Bush's most vocal Senate critic, Barbara Boxer, said she was ready to work with Bush on his initiative. Environmental groups were less gracious. One called Bush's plan a complete charade. Philip Clapp, president of the National Environmental Trust, noted that Bush's remarks focused not on new regulation, but the promise of technology.
It's almost a little bit like saying to passengers on the Titanic, what you have is a long-term technology problem.
If President Bush's last-minute proposal annoyed G8 summit head Angela Merkel, the German chancellor didn't let on, but neither could she resist a little dig. Bush's announcement today made it clear, she noted, that no one can avoid the question of global warming anymore. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Beyond calling for high-level talks about climate change, the president's plan today was short on specifics. One proposal gaining momentum in Congress, though, is something called cap and trade. The government would establish a gradually shrinking limit or a cap on carbon emissions. Businesses would then trade carbon credits or quotas to comply with the limit. Companies that figure out ways to lower their own emissions can make money selling those credits to companies that need them. Electricity generation accounts for one-third of greenhouse gas emissions, and so the utility industry is especially attuned to any effort at regulating carbon. So it's something of a surprise, then, that one of the biggest advocates of cap and trade is the CEO of one of the country's biggest power companies.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Jim Rogers of Duke Energy. Rogers has been vocal about the power industry's need to be at the table when Congress writes the rules, and that he wants the rules to favor a cap-and-trade system, not a straight-out tax on CO2 emissions. When we talked the other day, I asked him why cap-and-trade's okay, but a tax isn't.
In the U.S., there are 25 states where more than 50% of the electricity comes from the burning of coal. Under a carbon tax system, the government gets the revenue, and they might use it for Social Security. They might use it for road building. There's no guarantee that the government would use these revenues to help smooth out the transition period and offset the price increases that are going to hit that part of our country that's heavily dependent on coal. In the same way, a cap-and-trade system would allow that to happen. Think about California. California has limited reliance on coal to generate electricity. So the people of California wouldn't be adversely impacted in the same way those from Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, in the industrial Midwest, where they're heavily dependent on coal to generate electricity. A cap-and-trade system allows the smoothing out of that over time.
Let me make an analogy, if I might, to national broadcasting. You know, I mean, you have to pay for the right to use the airwaves in this country. Phone companies do it. Broadcasters do it. Why not require payment for the right to use the air, as it were, and make industries pay for emissions quotas?
I think it goes back to imposing a regulation based on where we are today. We develop coal generation in this country because it's an abundant natural resource. And when these plants were built, there was no law that prohibited emissions of CO2. We built the plants in good faith that we were in compliance with the law. As we look out to CO2, we're prepared to spend those incremental dollars, but we recognize the need that we have time to comply. We have time for new technologies to develop to make a transition.
You know, you've mentioned a couple of times, Mr. Rogers, the phrase time and how you need time to make this transition and time to install the equipment and time to figure out new technologies. Almost no matter where you stand on the science of climate change and global warming, there is a press here that maybe we don't have a lot of time to make some of these changes.
I agree that we need to go to work now because we have a sense of urgency about dealing with this problem, and the more the evidence comes in, the greater our sense of urgency. The sooner we go to work, the sooner we solve the problem. And because I recognize, as many do, that we're not going to solve this in one day, one month, one year, one decade. It's going to take a number of decades, and it's going to take a sustained effort to get this done. I mean, I wish I could snap my finger and say, no more CO2 emissions. But think about how unrealistic that would be in the context of 50% of our electricity coming from coal.
You know, the Europeans instituted a cap-and-trade market a number of years ago, and in the time since, it's actually been proven not to have worked so well. The price of carbon has, in essence, collapsed. Emissions there are up. How can we know that we would get it right over here?
First of all, they didn't get the allocation of allowances right. Germany is a wonderful example where they allocated them to the companies. The companies didn't pass through the benefits to the customers, and it translated into higher prices for customers and a windfall to the companies in Germany. That was a failure by the German government. One of the things I've learned is it would be a mistake just because the European Union didn't do it perfectly to say, no, it doesn't work.
A phrase that keeps popping up when reporters and people they talk to talk about Jim Rogers is unexpected advocate, that you are not necessarily a guy that people might expect to be in the vanguard of calling for regulation on climate change. Why you?
Several reasons. One, I recognize it's a problem. Two, I think it's going to take a long time to solve it. Third is we're the third largest consumer of coal in the United States. We emit, as a consequence of burning that coal, almost 100 million tons of CO2. We have a special responsibility to go to work on this issue and come up with solutions.
Jim Rogers is the chairman and CEO of Duke Energy, based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Mr. Rogers, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. I'm delighted talking with you.
Check our website for more on Jim Rogers and Duke Energy, and you can hear conversations from other corner offices there, too. It's marketplace.org. Debate on the immigration bill set to pick up when Congress gets back from its Memorial Day recess next week. Passage is by no means a sure thing, even though President Bush is urging lawmakers to reach consensus. Groups from every point of view have found something not to like in it. Each year, almost 100,000 people come here from the southern Mexican state of Guerrero. Most of them are men looking for work and economic opportunity. But Joy Diaz from KUT in Austin, Texas, reports the families they leave behind seldom share in the benefits.
Ana Laura Jerónimo Bueno is 33 years old. She looks much older, but her eyes flash determination and her voice is strong. Neighbors often stop by the small house where she lives with her four kids and her mom and dad. She lives in her parents' place because she can't afford a house of her own. Jobs are scarce here, and they don't pay much. So 6 years ago, her husband Oswaldo went to look for better opportunities in America. She gave him her blessing, but she never dreamt how things would turn out.
He actually got married over there and never came back. Some people say he even has children. So he stopped sending things to my kids. He doesn't call them or anything.
Many women here are in the same boat. As for the men, well, so many of them have gone. Ana Laura remembers when religious festivals like this one would have local men playing prominent roles. Nowadays, the Roman soldiers guarding the tomb of Jesus are about 12 years old. Their mothers often take two jobs to survive. At first, Ana Laura was embarrassed to tell her story, but she came across other women in exactly the same situation. They formed a group which they call, strangely, Wetback Wives. And they set up a website that urges the U.S. government to enforce its laws and deport their husbands. It's having little impact. Nina Pruneta is a spokesperson with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service, or ICE.
As to our knowledge, our office has not received any sort of information dealing with any sort of website.
Pruneta has heard hundreds of stories like Ana Laura's. She acknowledges that deporting the men might reunite the families, but she says the U.S. government must set priorities, like getting rid of illegal immigrants who pose a threat to the nation.
Priority-wise, definitely is national security with public safety, because those are the individuals we want desperately to go after.
If Ana Laura's husband is guilty of bigamy, that's a crime, and it would make him liable for deportation. But Ana Laura would need to bring evidence to the U.S. authorities. Moreover, many men wouldn't necessarily return to their families in poor, job-strapped Guerrero. Mexican consular officials do what they can to help. Carmen Cortez Harms is with the Mexican consulate in Austin, Texas. She says there are ways to compel estranged husbands to send money back to their children. Here's what she advises the women to do.
They should go to the office of the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Mexico and present a request. It's free. And just give the information, where can we locate the husband, and we call him. And let me tell you, about 80% of the people start sending money.
The consulate works out direct agreements with employers of the 20% of Mexican men who refuse to send back child support voluntarily. Employers deduct a portion from the paychecks, and the money gets to families in Mexico through the consulate.
It may take 3 to 4 months, but they do get the money.
Last year, Mexicans working abroad sent more than $25 billion to their families back home. Not all that was for child support. If Ana Laura manages to get money from her husband, it would be about $300 a month. Not a fortune, but enough to make a huge difference in her life and her children's. In Tecalpulco, Mexico, I'm Joy Diaz for Marketplace.
Coming up, when you're 40 years old and still somebody's roommate.
Usually, I insist on meeting my dates in their neighborhood. So if we go back to anybody's place, it won't be mine.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street didn't know which way was up today as mixed economic numbers faced off against some major corporate deals. The Dow Industrial shuffled down 5 points, basically flat, to end the day at 13,627. The tech-heavy NASDAQ shrugged up 11 points, 0.4%, closed at 2604. And the S&P 500 pretty much sat on its hands, up less than a point, also basically flat, to finish at 1530. A whale of a day, as I mentioned, for the financial sector. That Wachovia acquisition of A.G. Edwards we talked about brought a tide of investor interest. A.G. Edwards surged 14.25%. Buyer Wachovia didn't fare quite so well. It shed 0.2%. Corporate services firm Ceridian leapt 3.4% on news that it would be acquired by Fidelity National Financial. Fidelity stepped up 1.75%. Northwest Airlines emerged from bankruptcy protection today. Wall Street welcomed it back with open arms. Shares took off 2.75%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment for May. In Detroit, automakers release sales figures for the month of May. And Dr. Jack Kevorkian is back in the public eye. His scheduled release from prison tomorrow could fuel more talk on physician-assisted suicide. He served over 8 years on a second-degree murder conviction in the death of a man with Lou Gehrig's disease. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Here's a tip-off as to Walmart's economic pull, if you needed, you know, another one. Shareholders were treated to concerts by Beyoncé and American Idol Taylor Hicks during the company's annual meeting last year. Tomorrow, investors and employees will gather at company headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, for this year's meeting, and they could probably use a little entertainment this time around, too. Walmart's stock has been flat, sales growth is sluggish, and it's had more than a couple of public relations black eyes. Just today, the New Jersey Supreme Court approved a class action lawsuit against it. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more now on Walmart's malaise.
Walmart's annual shareholder meetings are always mad affairs. Beyoncé and Taylor Hicks weren't the only acts last year.
They actually had a musical, Walmart the Musical, and it was corny.
That's Patricia Edwards, portfolio manager at Wentworth, Hauser, and Wielich. Walmart is keeping its plans for this year's meeting close to the vest. Edwards plans to tune in via webcast. She says shareholders will be looking for signs the company's getting back on track. Edwards says her fund owns about 40,000 shares of Walmart right now,
which is down from 1.2 million shares 3 years ago. We got out at roughly $60.
Selling was a good move. The stock has hovered in the $40 to $50 range over the last year. Peter Sorrentino has held on to his shares as portfolio manager for Huntington Asset Advisors. But he says Walmart is up against some tough obstacles. The company's low to middle income customers have been hit hard by higher gas prices. They're less likely to drive to the stores. When they do, they don't spend as much. And there's a union-backed campaign hammering Walmart's labor and environmental practices. Sorrentino says the bad press is hurting worker morale.
Walmart's being portrayed in the press almost, you know, consistently as sort of the big evil out there in the world. And I think that has an effect on the employees of the store.
Spirits are apparently so low that Walmart started airing half-hour infomercials on cable TV aimed at its own workers.
And how we're making Walmart an even better place to work.
Shareholder Patricia Edwards says Walmart is also trying to recover from recent allegations that it spied on some activists and investors.
not exactly what makes Wall Street want to do a lot of business with them. It can be very difficult for you to want to invest other people's money in a stock if you think that perhaps they're not running the business the way you would like them to run the business.
Walmart is working to clean up its image with investors and the public. It's about halfway through a 3-year plan to revamp its stores, improve its merchandise, and get grocery shoppers to buy bigger ticket items like electronics. It's also launched a green campaign to curb energy use by its stores and suppliers. Analyst Mark Husson follows the stock for HSBC.
I think that they should be applauded for some of the initiatives they've taken in terms of recycling and in terms of using, you know, fluorescent light bulbs, simple things like that. And it's not just a question of empty rhetoric. I think they actually believe it.
Now it may be a question of getting investors to believe in Walmart again. One item of business at tomorrow's shareholder meeting is the election of a new board member. Alan Questrom is former CEO of JCPenney. He's known as a retail turnaround expert. He said one of his top priorities will be improving Walmart's PR. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
As we wait patiently for the housing market to decide when it's done falling, the news has been of the follow-on effects: falling share prices for home builders and heavy equipment makers, and whether or not there's a wider economic impact. Commentator and New York City renter Doug Cordell says, oh, you bet there is.
You don't expect to find yourself in your 40s and having a roommate. Not a live-in lover, a roommate. As in, could you turn your music down? And that was my milk. But having been away from New York for a few years, I came back to find myself priced out of the market. Forget Manhattan. I couldn't afford to rent a place in Queens. It turns out when the housing market goes soft, as it has even in crazy money New York, the rental market tightens up because first-time buyers sit on their hands in their rented apartments and wait for sales prices to hit bottom. Thus to Craigslist and a share in some guy's two-bedroom walk-up. Life as a roommate in your 40s. In conversation with people, I make only vague references to my housing situation to avoid the embarrassment. I also skip any of my roommates' favorite haunts, especially when I'm out on a date. Usually, I insist on meeting my dates in their neighborhood, so if we go back to anybody's place, it won't be mine. On the plus side of being a mature roommate, you've proven to anyone who cares to know, an old girlfriend, say, who shall remain nameless, that yes, you can live with someone. Indeed, after several years of living alone, you've discovered it can be kind of nice to share. Even something as simple as a newspaper or a bag of cookies. And even with a relative stranger, someone who walks around in an open bathrobe practicing arias for his amateur opera club. The main thing is, with the money I save on rent, I'm able to afford things I couldn't otherwise. Better restaurants, a regular haircut, nicer clothes. In fact, I probably look more successful now than when I had my own apartment, as long as I'm not actually in my apartment. And who knows? If the housing market keeps tanking, maybe I'll be able to get a place of my own again. A nice little one-bedroom, all to myself. Or maybe a two-bedroom would be a better idea. Just to have the option of renting out the other room, if I feel the need. Financially speaking, I mean.
Doug Cordell lives and writes in New York City. Take a minute to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note for you today, eHarmony is one of the biggest online dating sites in this country. It promises its 12 million registered users a scientifically engineered perfect match, if you're a heterosexual. Unlike most dating sites, eHarmony doesn't offer a men-seeking men or women-seeking women category. eHarmony's founder, Dr. Neil Clark Warren, is an evangelical Christian, and he says he doesn't know enough about the dynamics of same-sex relationships to apply his partner-managing algorithms to gay couples. So today, a San Francisco woman sued the company over those practices. Linda Carlson says they're illegal under California's anti-discrimination statutes. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 5 points. We'll call that one basically flat. The NASDAQ jumped 11 points, about 0.4%. The S&P 500 bumped up less than a point. Not really worth a mention percentage-wise. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Stacey Vanek-Smith, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, the value in donating books to kids.
When I grow up, I think I would go to the reading store because I would love to read books more when I grow up, since I love books now.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.